Eternal
Extra, we feature stories from ourselves and from some well-known anglers. We've got Kevin Nash, Alan Blair, John Mack, Daryl Peck, Ronnie De Groot, and Frank Warwick, all making an appearance on this episode. And we, as we have done in previous episodes of the Carpcast, we basically tried to get stories out of everybody. We've asked them questions and we reminisce. We've got it's a bit of a mishmash, this one. There's kind of three main topics. Not everybody answered all of the questions. But we're doing one about fishing ruined my life. Stories of maybe where you became so obsessed about a particular fish that you just had to, you know, throw everything aside. You were taking sick days off work, or you know, your missus left you, or you lost your job or whatever, just because of the obsessive OCD, obsessive carp disorder that gets us all at some point, doesn't it, I think, Mark? Have you ever been OCD'd?
Without a doubt, without a doubt. And when we were both chasing the fish around Pit 2, it's good for me, for my real life, that I caught the twin when I did. Because, well, I didn't fish for about 6 weeks afterwards while I put the rest of my life back on track. You know, as long as I had 20 quid left in my overdraft to fill the van up with fuel, I was fishing. You know, it's not a great way of living. It's ultimately destructive.
Yeah, it's not good. But we've all been there. I certainly have. Which is great at the time, because you're just single-minded. And it does help you kind of focus and catch that fish. But
oh, yeah. Definitely, but it's a lesson learnt as well. You know, I've learnt to, I was obsessed with a lady, but, you know, for different reasons, just stuff that was going on in personal life back then. But I've learnt the lesson not to get overly obsessed. There are more important things than a big slimy fish and getting a picture of it. Not many, but there is. It's all about balance.
Yeah, completely agree. But we get a few stories from people where, you know, fishing either ruined it or nearly ruined their life. We have a look at disaster sessions as well. A few of the guys have tell stories of a session where it all went wrong. And some funny stories as well. We got a few, you know, comical or hilarious sessions out of some of the guys. And can you remember anything particularly funny, Mark?
There's one session that springs to mind, which you've got the editing privilege of this podcast, so this may not make it to air. But this is a session on St. Ives that includes a bit of alcohol, a bream, and some poo. You remember that one?
Oh, dear. I'm not sure if I can tell the full facts of that story.
Shall I, then?
Go on.
Yeah. Well, there was us two, and you know, Swoopy Dave and another lad, Techno Tom, had joined us from a lake further down the chain, and
we're having a few. Tom, who owns ATT Angling?
I think he came up with them. The idea, the little ATT buzzers that are so popular, and we're having a few drinks and burger or whatever else, and you hooked a fish, didn't you? Which at the time you were convinced was the lady. It got stuck in the marginal weed, and it was out of netting range. So we weren't overly drunk, but, you know, we'd had a few beverages. You decided to strip down to your trellis, go for a wade to land this, what you were convinced was a lady.
Yeah, all the time I needed a dump really badly, but I didn't want to go because I thought I had the lady on.
Yeah, you got in the water up to your nether regions, and bladder bowel control was lost.
Yes, let's leave it there, shall we? But I soiled myself, and it wasn't the lady, it was a snotty bream.
Yeah, he was a bit of a shitter.
Yes. Oh, no. Stop. We can't do that. One of our favourite storytellers is Mr. Ronnie DeGroote, and it's his only appearance on this one. But he had a funny story or a funny session that he told us about.
Well, funniest session, and then I have to think about Lake Bracciano in Italy. Lake Bracciano is one big volcanic lake. It's next to Bolsena, which is the place where the World Cup Classics has been for 3 years. From 2012 to 2014. And Bracciano is, let's say, the smaller brother. It's only 4,000 hectares, which is more or less 9,000 acres, I think. There are a few bigger carp in Bracciano than in Bolsena, but the average weight is much lower than in Bolsena. Lake Bolsena, you know, 17, 18 kilo carp, so upper 30, 40 pound carp is not really uncommon. It's very uncommon on Bracciano. It's rare to catch carp over 15, 60 kilogram. But for one or another reason, there is a very big gap between, let's say, 15, 16 and 27, 28, 30 kilograms. So there are a few, but not that many. I think maybe 3-4 really big carp in that lake. And so I went to fish that lake, and of course I hoped to catch one of these big ones. So I went to there. I have some really great friends in that area. I like Italy. I have been fishing there for carp many years, since 97 for the very first time. My best friend is an Italian guy. It's more a brother than a friend to me. And so one of my local friends brought me to Bracciano. He said, look, I had told him, I said, I'm looking for a shallow area, because it was just before spawning time. And I said, I think that a big part of the carp population will come to that area to spawn, because the bank is going under an inclination of 45 degrees down. So that means, let's say, 10 meters from the bank, it's about 10 meters deep, more or less. And that counts for, let's say, 95% of the lake. So if you can find somewhere a shallow plateau, well, you can put your money on it. It will be a good bet, that carp will be in that area. So I had said to a friend of mine, I'm looking for a shallow area. Can you bring me to? He said, no problem. I have a friend who has a private swim there. You can use it. So I went to there. So I arrived there, and that friend of a friend, his name was Ciccio. Ciccio means in Italian the fat one, the big one. And he was, let's say, a very healthy boy, 1 meter 85 and let's say 130-140 kilos. So he was a proper bloke. And when I arrived there, he said, Jesus Christ, Ronnie, that you do me that honor to fish in my swim. He said, unbelievable. I say, oh, calm down, mate. I have to go to the toilet just like everybody every day, or it is in my pants. He said, no, mate, you're a star. I said, okay, if you think that I'm a star, so be it. I said, but I'm happy, that you are happy, and so on. So we went to his swim. So I set up all my tackle, started fishing, and so on. Believe it or not, I think the second day of that session, I caught one of these big ones. How big was it? 29.3 kilos, 1 meter and 80 centimeter long. That's, that's for me one of my best catches ever, certainly from such a big lake and so on. you know, within 2 hours, I think half of the village has passed by. They came, you know, and the funny thing was, Chicho had a friend, and his friend, his name was Giancarlo, it was Gigi in Italian. And it was funny, you know, Chicho was 1.85 meters, 130-140 kilo, and Gigi was, I think, 1.55 meters or something like that, and he weighed maybe 50 kilos or even less, you know, very funny guy. So they arrived in the swim, they had 10 or 20 friends with them. I had to sign boats, I had to... the only thing I did not have to do was to make the girls a baby, but, you know. Anyway, you know, that was big news over there. So, and he said, may I ask you a favor? I said, of course you may ask me a favor. I said, you do me a favor that I can fish here. I said, well, how can I help you? He said, can we fish with you at night? I said, yeah, no problem. I said, you come over, you know, I will fish with one rod and you both fish with two rods, and that's fine for me. I said, I caught fish for this trip or for this year, so, you know. So they arrived in late afternoon. I heard them coming from, you know, from miles away, because they were, you know, it was a very funny couple. A lot of noise, and you know, if you don't understand the language, you would think that they were having an argument every second, you know. But it's not. It was their way of behaving and talking with each other. And Gigi, the small one, he said, "Can you tie me a rig?" I said, "Yeah, of course I can." So he showed me a couple of hooks, and I said, "Gigi, mate, do you really mean that?" He looked at me. He said, "What's the matter?" I said, "You can't catch a big carp on that kind of hooks." He said, "Is that true?" I said, "Of course, mate." He showed me another one, same story, of course, but it was just a pull in my leg. And I said, "You know, don't. I'm just joking." I said, "Give me your first hook," and that was a hook where the point was set to the to outside. You know what I mean? It is not in the same line of the shank of the hook.
Yeah.
It's quite a little bit, you know, to the outside of the hook.
Yeah.
So what I do was I made a liner on that side so that it turned always in that direction, and so that it became an aggressive hook every time and not 50% of the cases. So, but as it was a quite big hook, I said, okay, I'm going to, and it was a hard bottom, I said, I'm going to use a very short hook link, 8 centimeters. Yeah, it was not 10 centimeters, I think something like 8 centimeters. And my other friend who has brought me to that swim, he arrived in the swim, he said, "What? Are you going to catch a carp? You can't catch a carp like that." And Gigi said, "You know, what do you know about fishing? If Ronnie says that I can catch a carp on that rig, I can catch a carp on that rig. You know, you silly guy." So I was just laughing. So anyway, so we boated out his rod, and I said, "Look, most action." So I was fishing near weed, and it was obvious. So one day, all the action came from my left-hand rod, for example. The other day, the right-hand rod. The other day, the middle rod, whatever. So I said, all the action come from the middle rod at the moment. I said, it's best to go in that direction. So we boated out his rod. He placed it, I think, 5 meters away from my rod there. And within 3/4 of an hour, he caught his first fish. His personal best then was exactly 30 English pound, 30.6 kilos.
Yeah.
Believe it or not, it was a 15 kilo plus, which is a very good fish for that lake. Mm. So he was over the moon. And he, of course, he was calling my other friend, Emiliano, which is a very good angler, by the way. He was calling them all dirty words. You know, "What does he know about fishing? That idiot." You know, you see it. Within 45 minutes, I catch my new personal best. And, you know, it's really typical Italian. Yeah. I loved it. I, you know, so I said, okay, mate, really well done. You know, now we're going to take some pictures and so on. But he was dressed to go play football. So that means he was dressed very, very nice pair of jeans and so on, because he had to play some football in the evening, and then he would come back and say, you know, it's fine, but you know, when you get personal best, you have to go into the water. I said, that's tradition. Of course, with all his nice clothes on, I sent him into the water, took some pictures and so on. Anyway, so he had to drive back home completely soaked to change his clothes and so on. So he went playing football that night. He came back that evening. He came back. He caught one or two other more carp, and in the morning they had to go to a funeral, which is not funny, of course. It was a friend of them, but anyway, so they were gone, and they came back about 2 hours later. And I really heard them from at least 100 meters distance, and they were shouting to each other. And I heard something like piedi and machina, which means rock and car. And I said, hey, guys, I don't really, you know, in my Italian, then I said, look, guys, I don't understand what's going on. I said, I understood the word piedi, which is stone, rock, and car. He said, yes, I've bumped with my car to a stone, and my car is broken. I said, where's your car? He said, 50 meters down the road. I said, okay, we're going to have a look. So we went to there. And indeed, when I arrived, I saw that his right tire was flat. But if I had a better look, you know, his left wheel of his car was pointed in straight forward, and the right wheel of his car was pointed completely right. So the axle was broken. I said, "Yeah, mate, it's indeed a little bit more than just the tire. It's the axle." And then I looked through the roof of his car. And believe it or not, that was completely destroyed. I said, Jesus Christ, what has happened? He said, yes, Ronnie, in a moment of that I lost my control, I smashed with my arm on the roof of my car. And I say, you know, I almost pissed myself. I said, that cannot be possible. So he opened his door and he smashed on the inside of his car, bang, and that... how do you say the, you know, the you know, it came more or less back into the shape it was before. I said, this is not possible. And I went to his side of the car, so on the driver's side. And there is a metal part between the front door and the rear door. And there was also a bump in that. And I said, what was that? He said, yes, Ronnie, if I had continued to smash the roof, it was completely broken. So I smashed on this side. I said, you're completely mad, you know. You cannot, this is something what you cannot make up. If you see that on television, you say, you know, this is over. This is over the top. It's overdone. But it happened for real. And I've seen it, and I left home about 4 hours later, and I was still laughing. And every time I think and that story again, I see it happen straight away for me, and you know, it makes me always smile. So that is certainly one of the funniest sessions I've ever had on a bank.
Thanks very much to Ronnie. It was. I guess with his one, it was one of them ones where you kind of had to be there. It's. I don't think it was funny as a poo story, but it was a session that was obviously funny to him. Those sessions where you're with mates and you just can't stop laughing all the way through, you know, where you just, it might be similar things that nobody else would find funny, but you get like little running jokes throughout the session where you're just ribbing each other and stuff. And I think Ronnie's was a bit like that. I had one on when I was fishing Yateley, Car Park Lake, Swoopy Dave. He did a session on the what was the lake right behind it, Split Lake. Did a session on there, and he ended up having a few fish. But I was like bivvied up on one bank where he was like backing onto me as the lakes backed onto each other. So obviously it was like we were having a good social, and we were just stiffing each other up for the entire session. You know, dropping like bits of rubbish like. things that nobody wanted. We were stashing in each other's bivvies or trying to dump my rubbish bag in his rubbish bag.
You've always done that.
Yeah.
But the number of times I've fished with you and I've been packing up and there's a random bag of rubbish that's just like hanging underneath my barrow that I've not noticed as I'm putting this gear in the car.
The best one is if you get to the car park first, is when you pack your gear in your motor, you just leave your bag of rubbish on the roof of your mate's car, and then they've got no choice but to bring it home. It's even worse now, talking about poo again, like it's become quite common for people to bag and tag it now in the SAS style. It's way more hygienic to pull the door down on the bivvy and drop one into a bag and dispose of it on the way home. And so there's nothing worse than dumping a bag of rubbish on your mate that's got a week's worth of turds in it.
Oh, I was actually unrelated to fishing, but I was behind a car a few weeks back and it had your little doggy poo bag. It was hanging from its rear wiper as it was driving around swinging like a poo pendulum.
Yeah, so the old stiffing people up with your rubbish was always a good one, or hiding the lighters, nicking the lighters. Also, we had a really good funny session, me and Dave, that one. We've had a few over the years, but it's quite good when you just get in that mode and you're stitching each other up. And they're some of the best sessions, aren't they? Because we all get obsessed with the fishing, we all get the obsessive compulsive disorder, but sometimes, you know, it's just about being with your mates in it and having the crack. And hopefully, a few of these funny stories come across. Have you had a disaster session, Matt?
You know, you just mentioned this, and there is a couple spring to mind, but it's more like, the first one is a near disaster, and you'll remember this one. My first capture of the import from Pit 2. Sunken island, it's weeded up, very close in, ice strips off just to go in and net it, you've got the rod. And then anyone knows Pit 2 is very steep and clay-bottomed. I'm just stretching out to get the fish in the net. The fish moved. It actually literally rolled right in front of me. I slipped, lost footing, and slid down the shelf. I went right under, over my head and the lot, and I panicked. So I'm like, arms flying everywhere, trying to get some perches, swim out. The fish is, like, flapping. I'm getting tangled up in the line. And despite all that, we actually did manage to get it in. Do you remember that one?
I do, yeah, I do. I think it was my fish, actually. I believe I had the rod in my hand and it was me that netted it while you were still stuck out in the water. I think it was mine, that one.
Yeah, you. I'll just superimpose you onto the picture. But I had a repeat of that fish anyway, so it's all relative. But the other one is another. Remember I told a story, I had six in the morning from Icombe last year. What I've not told about that session is I bust my brolly and snapped a rod. my brolly's my own fault. It just, all the ribs came away from the centre pole because I don't look after things and pack it away wet. And after a few years, it had, the wire around the middle rusted and it bust. But the rod, that was my own fault. I'd already caught a couple of fish. My cradle, I'm thinking I'm packing up soon, it's in the sun. I've stood it up on its end to dry out. I'm playing another fish, which turned out to be an 18-pound linear. There's a gust of wind, and the cradle went falling down. It fell down the bank, landed on my rods, and snapped one.
Oh.
That was the middle of the boat section, and that was one of, a rod that retails at nearly 400 quid.
My disaster session, I believe you were there, was on Elstow 2 as well. I've spoke about this on the normal podcast, so I'll briefly gloss over it. But it started with me getting into this sunken island peg, which is obviously very steep. I got into the peg, which is where I knew what it to be. It was going to be a warm week, so I'm kind of in like shorts and a t-shirt. I used a Coleman at the time where we needed petrol to fill it up. I didn't have any petrol, so I kind of secured the peg. Went to the garage, local BP garage on the roundabout. Ended up getting covered head to toe in petrol because the petrol light pipe had obviously split, so I've got the nozzle into my green petrol canister, and then when they activated the pump, it was just like a 20-foot jet of petrol that covered me head to toe. Ended up shutting the garage down, you know, all the sirens went off, and it, you know, it was like rush hour as well in the morning. Covered head to toe, had to take all my details and everything, because obviously I've been assaulted. So eventually, after filling out forms and all sorts of stuff, I got back to the lake. I first cast with my marker rod, the tip snapped about 4 inches off it. Maybe it got damaged in the bag or whatever, I don't know. It was only like a gentle lob. I remember cooking my curry, like it's a very steep peg at like 45 degree angle, maybe even steeper, and there was like a ledge halfway down that used to bivvy up on, so you're a good like 10 foot above your rods. And I remember I used to make like these Patak's curry. Used to get a tin of curry paste and mix it all up. I remember cutting the onions, preparing everything, frying the meat, putting the sauce in. I had this pan on my Coleman on this shelf, and I kicked it with my foot on the full cooked pan of curry, which was the only food that I had for that day. Rolled down the slope, and that was my dinner gone. I lost a fish. Bear in mind, you could go a month without a bite on there. I mean, I went 26 days for my first fish. Yeah, 26 nights and days for my first fish on there. There was a period in the autumn where the whole lake went 2 months without doing a bite. Like, you know, bites were fairly rare on there, being a very low stock lake at the time. And so it was significant to lose a fish. And I ended up losing a fish in the edge. The fish were coming right in close, which was a reason for bivvying halfway up the cliff. It was, everything went wrong that session, and I think I'd had my first fish. I think I caught the mother the week before, and Elsa had a habit of doing that, didn't it? The carp gods or the anti-carps kind of shone down.
It was a spirit of the lake.
Spirit of the lake, yeah. That was my disaster session.
I've just remembered another disaster as well.
Well, let's get somebody else in. Let's get John Mack in for his disaster session.
Yeah, I've had loads of things go wrong, but one particular that stands out, I can't think. Literally, I mean, if it's happened to anyone, it's happened to me. And then, like, normally you turn it around and you get one. I've had it all. You know, when you get to a lake and cast out your marker maybe, and you find a clear spot or whatever, and you clicked up and you cast to it, and you spent hours finding a clear spot, and a swan's just come along and messed it right up, swam through your lines, and you had to start again. Or, and you're there, you're pulling your hair out, you are in despair. Someone will pass and go, "All right, John," like, no, it's not, I'm not all right, no. Just want to hang yourself from a tree nearly, and it's so bad. But I mean, yeah, I've had everything like that go wrong, obviously, you know, crack offs, bird nest, bloody everything. But fish lost, pulled up at a lake, my vans broke down. I mean, what else? I mean, really, really bad. I mean, I can't think. Fishing at range, it's a nightmare. So I can't really give one definitive. So, yeah, I've had it all go on.
Thanks to John. And, tell me about your disaster session you've just remembered.
Yeah, this goes back to around about the time we were fishing the Ives, chasing the lady, January. I decided to go down there for a couple of nights session. Not expected to catch anything at all, but I can give the lake a good thrashing with a marker float. But I had a bright idea. I thought, I've never seen this shallow lagoon. I'll drive over and have a look. I did, and I got my car stuck, which is never good. So, contacted Trevor, who used to run the lake from the shop.
Yeah.
He said he'd call me back, but it didn't sound very sympathetic, and he never did. So I walked into one of the George, the buildings, like all the industrial places, and see if they had anything that could tow us out, and to be fair, they did. one of the lads, he drove over there with one of the big, well, they call them the buckets, which is basically a massive, well, just bucket, which, how can I describe it? You must have seen them round. It's like contraption on these wheels are taller than what I am, and I'm 6'5". You know, yeah. It's got everything, it just bends in the middle. Anyway, he drove through the shallow gates towards where my car was. He hooked up the chain on my car, and he got stuck. Hooked up the chain, and he literally used his bucket to push himself backwards. Then, the last time I saw the shallow, the deep ruts in his tyre tracks were still there. You know, they were that big and deep. You know, he literally dug turrets in the ground down. They were at least 18 inch 2 foot. It was just like a sponge, the ground. Very deceiving to look at. But as he left me, he gave me a phone number of someone who may be able to help, which was like a commercial recovery person. It cost me almost £200 to call him out and get me out of that field.
That is a disaster session for a Yorkshireman, isn't it?
Disaster? I was devastated. It's nearly suicidal. And I caught nothing.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I was very, very annoyed with myself. But lesson learnt.
On a disaster session, I've got one that springs to mind. It was probably in the late 90s. I'd been fishing on Lac de Dare, Shanticock, quite a lot. And I'd gone down one particular session, and we'd had a hurricane, Hurricane Lily. I've wrote about it in the book, actually, this. And we'd had a session of all sessions. It started off badly, and then we caught an absolute ruck of fish, and it was incredible fishing. We couldn't keep the rods in the water. Constant big 30s and 40s all the time for 3.5 days solid. And consequently, the three of us did that trip. All our friends back in Manchester, who we told about the session, were going crazy to go. So the following year, we timed it exactly the same week, which was the first week in October. Same swim, but there was a full posse of us went down there, which was a bit stupid, really, but everyone was gagging to have a sample of that fishing. The wind conditions, the weather conditions were identical to the year previous. Exact same date, same swim, same bait, not a bite between us, nothing. It was as though there was no fish in the place, and we were gutted. So we're thinking, what are we going to do? Anyway, we decided to move swims, and we'd seen some fish showing. So it was in an awkward part of the lake. So we got all the gear packed up and moved. And one of our ways of catching these fish is fishing day-only spots where you can't night fish. Because your average angler wants to fish 24/7, and it's a big mistake on that place, because all those places where you can legally night fish are fished out, and you're struggling to catch fish because the fish just don't have the pressure. You know, they want to move. They don't just keep putting up with it, getting caught. So they want to move to places where they feel safe. So we'd rather sacrifice the nights and go on a campsite and then just bait up, let them get a full night's feeding, and then hit them in the morning. So that was the plan. Yeah, so we there was a particularly awkward spot where we were seeing fish crashing, so we decided to move there. But we got there in the dark, and there was Paul Hunt, a friend of mine, and Mark Burgess, and decided to do the baiting up, and a few other lads. So we get all these 10-kilo buckets, and we're walking through this Shanticock mud in the dark with two 10-kilo buckets, each one in each hand, with our waders on, chest waders. And I don't know if you've ever been there, but it looks like an estuary, a tidal estuary, when the tide's gone out. Well, we're yomping through this mud, and we've done about a quarter of a mile to try and get near the edge of the lake to start baiting up, ready for the following day. And it hadn't been trod on any of this mud before, so we're walking down it. Next minute, Paul Hunt, his nickname's Bill, he took one step forward and vanished up to his chest in this mud like quicksand. So we're all pissing ourselves laughing like you do, and he's up to his chest, top of his chest, in his chest waders, and we're thinking it's hilarious. Anyway, his expression changed, and he starts going down more. We're thinking, oh, hang on a minute, it's getting serious, this. And I could see he's a big guy. At the time, he was about 16 stone, and he was panicking, and he was nearly in tears, and he's saying, "I'm going to drown." So I realised the significance of it, and I says, "Run and get some wood. Use run. I'll try and dig him out." So I went in my waders and lay down and started trying to move the mud from around his chest and around his body to free him up before it sucked him in completely, and then I got stuck in it as well. So the more you move, the more it's getting a grip of you, and I'm in up to my waist trying to get him out, and then he's grabbing me, like he's got a vice-like grip, and he's taking me with him, and I'm thinking, shit, we're both going to drown in mud here. What a horrible death. And then it starts getting really serious. We're going down, and I'm thinking, oh, and then they came back with all branches and pieces of wood to try and, so we could grip it and spread the load, you know. I'm digging like a maniac to try and throw this mud out of the way to create a hole so we can get out. He had no way of getting out apart from take his chest waders off, and he lost his chest waders. They were stuck in the mud. I lost mine. So we're there in our socks, covered in mud from head to toe, our faces, hands, everything. The van's about a quarter of a mile away. Then we hear a couple of big, massive bangs coming from the van. And then we're thinking, oh, my God, someone's breaking in the van, licking our tackle while we're covered in mud with our lost our waders. So Big Bill, he's a bit of a handful. He even though he's covered in mud and he's been through this trauma that took us an hour to get out of, by the way, he goes running back across all these mud flats. He only stands on a broken Coke bottle, and it completely cut the bottom of his foot off. The wound was just savage. It was unbelievable. It must have needed 40, 50 stitches. You could see all the bottom of his foot was like a flap. And he carried on running. Anyway, it was some local hooligans just messing, smashing something up near the van. They hadn't touched the van. So it was all, you know, for nothing, this panic and running. He carried on running, got all mud in the sole of his foot in this massive wound. Anyway, he wouldn't go to hospital. So we went to the chemist the following day and got some iodine and stuff and treated it and as best we could. And he spent the whole of the next 8 or 9 days fishing with bin liners on his legs because we couldn't get any waders. And then we proceeded to blank there, didn't we? Which was pretty hideous. So then we decided to move. Our mates had some fish up to 53. On the other side of the lake, so we decided to move near them. So we, in our haste to get over there, we went with my dinghy fully inflated on top of the Mark Burgess's transit van, which we were travelling in. And we got near this swim, and there was all hawthorn bush van through there. Let's get the dinghy off and carry it through. And Burgess is a bit of a headstrong bugger. He just drives off straight through this canopy of trees with my dinghy on the top, and we get it to the other side, and it must have had 50 hawthorns stuck in it. So we get on the fish. It was minus 10, by the way, at night. So the dinghy's completely flat with all big thorns stuck in it, so I went off my head, and we were nearly fighting and that. And basically, every time we got a run, the dinghy was flat in minus 10, and we had to, because all the bites were coming in the dark, we had to blow it up and go out with it fizzing in the lake in rough conditions. And it was like a joke. It was bubbling away. And then by the time we'd got the fish and come back to the bank, the dinghy was flat. Oh, it was a session from hell. It was horrible. But and to top it all, Bill, he'd lost the sole of his foot nearly. He blanked. Can you imagine that?
Love a story from Frank. Let's move on and go and check out Alan Blair's disaster session.
Disaster sessions, again, you know, I've not really had a huge amount of disasters, again, touch wood, but if there's ever been a disaster with me going fishing, it's always revolved around flooding. And I can figure three instances. One, when I was very young, I worked in a hotel at the time. I'd done a Friday night overnight with a couple of pals, and I needed to get into the hotel first thing on Saturday morning to do my shift. No chance. The lake rizzed ridiculously through the night. We were out on an island, and we ended up having to wade all our gear back. You know, it was just a disaster. Everything was soaking wet. Another one would be fishing with Matt Downing, very good friend of mine. At the time I was a teacher, I was lecturing at college, and this particular session I decided to take a huge amount of the students' coursework along with me to do the marking. The marking went out the window, me and him ended up getting messed, well drunk, and the river ran directly behind the lakes we were fishing on, and it flooded over the banks into the lake. At the same time the lake was rising, all the students' coursework was destroyed, completely ruined. I had to go back and send massive apologies, get him to reprint it all, etc, etc, and in the end the EA come down and moved us on. They said, lads, you've got to pack up now, it's so dangerous, and get out of here. But we caught it. Was a result. I can look back on those photos now, and I've got photos of my bivvy, literally 2 foot up the side of the bivvy, everything soaking wet. And then the final flooded one was actually with Reedy. You might have heard this one. Again, not long after joining Nash, me and Reedy, real eager, we turned round to Gal, Mr. Bays, and said, Gary, we really want to go fishing tonight, can you recommend anywhere? And he said, lads, I've got the perfect place for you. I know this little river, it's only down the road, it does loads of fish. All you got to do is get set up underneath the road bridge, flick your rods out, and I guarantee you're going to catch some carp. And we did just that. We rushed down there after work, got all set up underneath this road bridge, and started fishing. Got our heads down, and the next thing I knew, Reedy was waking me up almost in tears because the river had risen. It wasn't just a normal river, it was a tidal river. And Gary deliberately didn't tell us about this, knowing that we'd set up underneath it, the tide had rise, and we got proper flooded in, Jay. We got that flooded in, we had to leave our bite alarms and bank sticks there until the river dropped back down again and we could go and retrieve them. And I remember having to go with Reedy to Tesco's at about 2 o'clock in the morning to buy complete sets of clothes for both of us because we were drenched the whole way through.
I can picture Basie.
No, and you know what I mean? We come in the next day, Gal, you're out of order. And there was just one big smile across his face. Thanks, Gal.
It's a funny time of year. I mean, it's April as we're recording this, and it's a bit in between, isn't it? Fish are sometimes not always on bait. Have you ever found that you've had like a lot of hook pulls at this time of year? Yeah, you ever found that on lakes? Yeah.
No, not really, but I use trebles. Now, I know what you're saying. I've never really experienced it myself, you know, around the spring, but, you know, it's not something that's totally unheard of because they're not really going for it yet, are they? You know, there's still a lot of lakes, and especially the way the weather's been over the last couple of weeks, it's still cold. You know, we just had that northerly blast.
Yeah.
You know, it's on the verge, though.
That's the thing. They're waking up slowly. But they're not like fully having it yet, and you know, certain lakes like the shallower lakes tend to kick off before others. You know, the bigger bodies of water take longer, especially if they're a bit deeper. As soon as you go to 8-10 foot plus, you know, they can be very slow. But I noticed when I used to fish wire years ago, and in the spring there'd be a period of like a week or 2 weeks where you were losing like nearly half the bites. Like you'd have the fish on, they'd just drop off, and you wouldn't get a hook pull at any other time of the year, except for that time of year. And it wasn't just like me, it was other people on the lake. And I've seen that common. I've only ever really seen it happen like kind of March, April time. I'm sure it's because the fish aren't, you know, you're only nicking them as opposed to catching them properly. You know, maybe it's because they're moving slower, lethargic, or not feeding heavy enough. Not really sure what it is, but I've seen it. Something else I've always found that time of year as well is, like, I mean, in years gone by, there never used to be a lot of weed around at that time of year because it had died off over the winter. But to be honest, we had such a mild winter this year. The lakes I've fished, there's still last year's weed around and even some green stuff. I don't know if you've noticed that.
Not really, but I've mentioned before on the main cast, you know, when I'm on Icom, the sailing club have dyed the lake to get rid of the stuff.
You know, so what do you find, like lakes that don't have a lot of weed in, or lakes in the spring, like early in the year, like the fish, they still won't cover. So if you can find some weed, that's 100%. It's normally when the fish are, or if there's any natural cover, such as snags or like an island out in the middle of the lake. I mean, that's where you tend to find them this time of the year.
Yeah. There's I watched it yesterday, actually. Dave Lane's latest blog on St. Ives Shallow Lagoon. And he, I mean, catches nothing. There's a few other people on the lake. They catch nothing. I believe he states there's been something like 3 fish out so far this year. But he also gets some tremendous footage by climbing a tree around the back of the snags in the outer bounds, and all the fish, including a couple of the big ones, are there. You know, they're just sat in the sun, they're sat in the cover, they're sat in the snags where nobody can cast a lead at them. And that's, you know, the three first things I look for in any lake, you know, new lake, old lake, whatever: wind, weed and snags. You know, if they're not in one, they'll be in one of the others. You know, if it's a new wind, get on the end of it. If there's weed there, you know, check it out, especially if there's not much weed. You know, that's how I fished Icom last year. You know, the shallower spots, the eelgrass still grew up. And the carp love it. And so the eelgrass and all that also usually comes up before Canadian. You know, because in years gone by on Icom, when it was mega, mega weedy, you know, the eelgrass early season was always the one. You know, before the stockies went in as well, the old originals, there was a couple of spots, one off the bypass bank. It was just a banker every time of year. As soon as the eelgrass come up, just especially when the bream spawned in it as well, and that's going to be coming very soon. If you've got a big head of bream in it and they start getting the fin over, just you don't have to chug a solid bag of pellets in there. The carp are already there. They're going to be feeding, and oh, I'm getting excited thinking about it.
It's a great time of year, isn't it? We've had, you know, we've obviously had the entire winter with not a lot going on. And you know, we're all looking to dust the rods off and get out there. Yeah, it's one of my favourite times of year, and it's just nice. You know, if you have fished all the winter, you're not really seeing many fish show, you're not seeing much activity, and in the spring you're like, you're expecting to see them pop their heads out and vortexes, and I mean, they always turn up at the shallow end, don't they? Like, as soon as that sun's out, you're going to find them either just below the surface or in any bit, if you've got any like 2, 3, 4, 5 foot of water, that's where the fish are going to turn up at some point.
Yeah, without a doubt. It's always nice as well that, you know, not just to be fishing in a T-shirt and flip-flops again, but to be checking your baited spots around the margins, around the shallow areas in the morning, and actually seeing where the fish have been. I mean, don't put your eggs all in one basket either. You know, you can fish your swim, but have other spots baited ready to move on to if you see action on them. And, you know, if you think of a matchman, but what we do is on a larger, longer scale. A matchman doesn't sit and fish one spot in his swim all day. He'll have, like, you know, either side of his margin, you know, an 8 meter line and a 13 meter line. You know, he'll have his waggler on set up, his feeder on set up, casting to an island or whatever he's got in front of him. You know, be multifaceted. Is that a word?
Yeah, it certainly is. Something when I used to speak to Jim Shelley many years ago, something he taught me was heavy baiting in the spring, and it only works if you're doing it, because I think the fish, they are waking up slowly, and if everybody's putting a lot of bait in, like, you're probably not, it's probably going to have like detrimental factors more than the benefit. But quite often in the spring, people are fishing, you know, single hook baits, just bags, and if you're the only one putting bait in, you can have some amazing results. I mean, I've spoke about it on the main carp cast, but I had a mega session on wire by doing 2 or 3 pre-baiting sessions, putting a full bucket of bait in before I fished, and I had a ridiculous, I had a season's worth of fish for, you know, half the syndicate, not everybody, but for half the syndicate, it was a season's worth of fish in a 3-night session, just by spotting the fish. I mean, it's a good time of year to be looking. I had binoculars out, it was a sunny day, I could just see the fish glistening, like the backs out of the water, just catching them. And that's a good tip for this time of the year, is to be super observant, looking for their vortexes under the water, for the little glistens of the backs just sticking out, because they're desperate for heat. Like, we've spoke about this many times on the carpcast, it's the water temperature, isn't it, this time of year. You know, the fish are gagging, they're cold-blooded, and which means their body temperature is the same as the water, and they're waiting for the first glimpse of heat, aren't they? And just you know, looking for them. They can give the location away, and I found them in a shallower area of the lake, an area that didn't tend to hold them, especially at nights. And, you know, I fed it so well in this area that they were staying there at nights. I was catching, you know, they were actively looking for the food, and it was Shelley that put me onto that, and it really worked. I've never really done it anywhere since. I've not really had the opportunity, but it certainly worked.
Was that boilies or particles you were piling in?
Both. It was my first year with Nash. It was about 12, 13 years ago, but I was putting like a full bucket, like 15 kilo of hemp out, and then there was maybe 2 or 3 kilo of boiling mixed in with it. With each load, I did it like 3 times every 2 days. up until I fished, but it really worked. I was catching from the off.
Yeah, I do remember that. You did have a good year that as well. It kind of set you up.
Yeah, I've spoke about this before, but every time I've had a good sort of early year, you know, start getting out there early doors, January, February, I've had a decent rest of the year. And this year's got off to one of those. It's only happened two or three times, but yeah, I've had a flyer this year. So we love the spring. We love it. One of the questions we asked a few of our guests, not everybody answered it, but it was when we've been obsessed by fishing, how it's affected your life, how it's ruined it. We teased it at the start, and then we asked Kevin Nash, did fishing ever ruin your life? So I'm sure as an angler that I know has been obsessed from the Warm World days, from Snake Pit, I'm sure fishing must have ruined your life at some point. Or is it the making of it?
It absolutely hasn't ruined it. It's been the making of my life, you know, as you were saying embarrassingly early on. You know, look at the life it's given me. I've always said I can pick up the phone probably anywhere around the world and say I'm coming over, and there'd be, you know, a smiley face and a bed at the end. You know, that's one of the greatest things fishing's given me. It's given me three wives. Now, you can look at that negatively. It's cost me a fortune in houses and that, but they're still friends, and I've got two great boys out of it. You know, yes, it's been disruptive with women in particular. You know, the fiance when I started the business taught me to sew. You know, she couldn't just cope with me fishing every weekend with my obsession with the Silver N40. But you know, hey, you know, in the obsession has come milking life, you know, making the most of it to the full. And I think so many people, such a high percentage of people, don't realise, you know, the greatest gift God has given them is a day out of their life. You know, make the most of it. You know, I just can't understand people that go to work, go home and wash each enders, go to bed. You know, just can't understand it. You know, and so in that obsession, I guess, I've milked life.
But we're lucky to have a passion that we can become obsessed over, you know, something that's not illegal, something that's healthy, and so yeah, I guess it's more of, rather than ruined it, it's
made it.
Yeah, but there's been some sacrifices, I'm sure. So
of course, it's been sacrifices, and honestly, there's probably been a lot of selfishness on my behalf. But you know, I think anyone who wants to get to the top of the tree, and any top sportsman, he's got to be single-minded. He's going to make sacrifices, and he's also going to be selfish to get there. You know, and yeah, you know, like he's talking about OCD. You know, that's now a medical term, and you know, it's a negative. But you know, to me, OCD in my case means passion and focus.
Yeah,
you know,
and being directed, and I'm glad to have a passion, and it's. Competition's inbuilt in our genes. We have to strive to be better for the human race. Absolutely. It's inbuilt. So that selfish element, it kind of goes with being successful. What selfish people can do, what successful people could have done, got to where they've got without being a little bit self-centered at times. Because
but more importantly is what we were talking about earlier. You know, they've got that competitiveness. You know, I used to earn serious money in engineering doing piecework. But you know, basically got so many hours to do a job. If you cut that time, you got those hours in your wage packet. If you went over the top, you owed them that time, but they didn't take out your wage packet. It's just next time you did a job, you know, they deduct those hours before you got any money. It was stunning. I was getting three times the average weekly wage then. There's 14 guys in this factory. Only three of us did the piecework. The other said, "Oh, we don't want to take the risk." There wasn't any risk. You know, they just wanted to plod along, you know, through life. And I'm sorry to say this, but there's such a large percentage of people are missing out on life because that's their way of life.
They want to do the minimum. They're maybe distracted by things you touched on there, by TV, by social media, by mundane stuff that's just there to kind of kill time, as opposed to, you know, it's like, I don't know what you'd call it. We used to call it bubblegum TV, because like you just sit there chewing, like tapping your foot, not really.
You meet someone,
just letting time go by.
You meet a fisherman, you ain't met for a while. Hey, getting on, you know, how's the fish going? Oh, I don't go now, I don't have time. like, met a bird or wife. You know, my answer is, well, don't you sleep at night? Yeah, and there's been a lot of times in my life where, because I was forced to work or I've got to placate the missus, yeah, first time I went down Warnwell, you know, yeah, she said, yeah, this is a family holiday, you're not fishing. I said, well, what are we doing at night? Sleeping. So, you know, you know, you know, I literally went out when we went back from where we take the kids and started fishing at 11 till dawn. You know, you do what you've got to do to get the achievement and where you want to go. There's no such thing as not having time.
We can safely say fishing did not ruin your life.
I wonder if fishing's ever ruined Daryl Peck's life. He seems a bit level-headed to me.
And I remember I changed girlfriends between it, but it was more my choice, to be honest. I don't think I have ever lost a job I've never got in trouble, like any trouble as a result of fishing all the time. You know, I've had arguments about it, but yeah, it's never cost me anything.
Yeah, I'm the same. It never has, really. I've got I would never let something control me enough for it to mess something up severely. But I was more thinking, obviously some people have, but when you read a lot of the older school anglers, like your Rod Hutchinson had stories about it. I mean, who was it? Was it in Hutch's boat? Like another well-known angler ran off with his wife because he was always fishing somewhere. It might have been in the Save days or something. I forget who it was, but
I think that used to go on a bit, didn't it?
Sorry?
Was it? I know that sort of stuff. Didn't Hutchie Nick Regan's wife or something along those lines? I'm sure Pete Regan has told me that once upon a time that he did have a wife and Rod Hutchinson stole her and that, because he was always up the lake and God knows what. But
that might have been the story, yeah.
So let that be a lesson, guys. While you're away, don't be leaving the missus at home for too long, because you never know what other carp angler might be going around to borrow a cup of boilies. Let's move on.
One of the things I remember, I got a job, I've been out of work for a bit, through fishing again causing me. I didn't want to get a job because I was too busy fishing, you know. And obviously I was at that age, I was about 18, and I got my folks, because I still lived at home, forced me to go and look for a job. So I got one for Stockport Council. I was doing bricklaying and hod carrying and learning the trade, really, building trade. Getting steady money. It was crap money, but steady. I got that in the winter and worked all through the winter. And then we start getting to the spring. And I was quite competent at the job. And the old 16th of June was creeping up, and all I could think about was Reedsmere and the start of the season coming, thinking about my mates on there on opening day, and I was going to be working, you know, because it didn't fall over the weekend. And I thought, oh, I'm not having this. How can I get sacked? So it looks like, you know, I've just been sacked for something. And in the end, I lost my rag and I went in the pub. We're on a big job, and I went in the pub on dinner hour and never came out the pub. And the clerk of work sent some Irish guys into the pub to try and get me out. And I said, I'm not coming back to work. You'll have to sack me. So they sacked me. And I had the job of going home and telling my mum and dad that I'd been sacked from work, you know. I didn't tell them why. And then I remember sat on Reedsmere opening day of the season, dead chuffed with myself, but also skint, you know, thinking, how can I pay for the bait and all the rest of it? And I guess that went on for quite a few years. Just getting sacked on purpose. I'd get a job, and then as soon as the spring had come and the season was coming, I'd get sacked again, you know. It's funny, isn't it, how it sort of overtakes your life, fishing, you know.
It's a way of life, and passion, and I bet there's been a few relationships lost as well.
I mean, my wife at the moment, I mean, she used to get threadbare. I don't know how she's put up with me over the years, you know. There's all kinds of things I've done. I mean, I used to get different girls and go out with them, and then they'd soon learn that I was absent most of the time. As soon as the summer come, I was off fishing, and you know, they could be absolute stunners. I could pull a bird, and they'd disappear, and oh, there's some crackers that have gone through fishing, you know. But maybe it was all for the right reasons. My missus at the moment, she's stuck with us through thick and thin. I don't know how she's done it, but I mean, I've pulled some stunts in my time with her, you know. I remember we had the kids, and she was like struggling with them, and like they are, and they don't want you to disappear doing stuff. And I was going to Lac de Dare, Shelton. We got it all planned, and I'd made 280 kilo of bait in Trevor's when I worked there. This was in the 90s, and I'd got it all laid out on a sheet in the shop, and he says, you have to move that now because I'm opening on the Monday morning. So I got this big bed sheet with all this bait drying out on it and put it in the living room because we lived in the flat above the shop. Mm. I mean, Mrs. came and she was, what are you doing with all that crap in here? It was squid and squid and cranberry it was. I remember that, all stinking the house out. And I said, oh, I'm going down Oxford for a week fishing. She said, you're doing what? I said, yeah, I'm going to Oxford to Linear fishing. She says, oh, what, why do you need all that? There's tons of bait there. I said, oh, they're feeding heavy at this time of year. It's about October time, you know. Yeah. Anyway, I buggered off to Lackadair for a week. My mates had to hide the car with the trailer around the corner so she didn't see it. And but you know, to this day, I still do stuff like that. You know, I'll I remember going to Romania for 10 days. Check this out. And I just landed in Bucharest with all the gear with my mate Guy, who's a DJ, and we've got 10 days on that tanker best that I was telling you about. And do you know when your phone comes back on when you're picking your suitcases up where you've had to turn it off? Well, I turned my phone on and I got a text, and the text said, I'm on my period this morning, you take the kids to school. So Guy went, are you real? He says, have you not told her? I says, no, I don't tell her. He says, you're here for 10 days and you've not told me that you're in Romania. I says, no, I said, it saves me getting all the shit. I said, I'd rather just go and do it and then her find out once I'm away and then cop for it when I get back. He goes, I can't believe this. Anyway, I sent her a message back. I said, I can't pick them up. I can't take them to school this morning. I said, because I'm in Romania for 10 days. Hey, you should have seen the text I got back. It was a cracker. Yeah, so I'm still at it now, you know, really. So fishing, eh? It's got a lot to answer for.
Well, she must be some woman to put up with that still.
Yeah, I mean, do you know what, there was I mean, I mean, my lads are the same, you know, they're mad on fishing, and I can see it all happening again with them, really. It's affected their school life, and they still try. Oh, Dad, can I come with you? Can I have a day off school and all? But I've had to stop it, you know. But they've seen me do some stuff, you know. But hey, just look, before I go, Jamie, let me just tell you one thing that with my two lads, it was so funny. It happened a bit back. It's not really connected with how things have grew in my life. But it was, I was out with my two lads, and I was trying to please my missus for once, you know, to make up for going fishing. So she says, oh, I want to do all the garden up front. Will you do the garden and decorate the house? So I've been doing loads of jobs. So I says, right, let's go down Winslow Garden Centre and get some plants and all that. So I got a few bob spare for it, you know. So we went down the garden centre, and she's got one of them big wheelie trolleys, and she's filling it up with tons of plants and everything. She's getting a bit giddy here. She's spending a bloody fortune. So we were bored watching her choose plants. So I got the boys, and they had a demonstration of garden sheds, but these weren't normal garden sheds, because we're talking about Winslow and Oldery Edge. You've got a lot of rich people around there. These were like sheds as big as, the, you know, most people's bungalow. And one of them, me and my boys went inside, and one of them was like dead jazzy. It got a sauna in it. It got a little area for doing a bit of workout and this, that, and the other. So we're looking at that. I thought, bloody hell, it was about 20 grand, this thing. So we went in another one next door, and it was like a fully laid out gymnasium, but also a martial arts practice place. And there was in the middle of this thing, it was really jazzy. There was one of them metal stands bolted to the floor, and it had, you know, them torsos where you do practice martial arts.
Yeah,
it had a six pack. It had a face on her head and a six pack, and behind it was two big sliding big windows like you'd have on a patio door. And there was no one about in there. And it got all these other punch bags and everything. So we're on the punch ball and the punch bag. And I used to do kickboxing and a bit of boxing when I was younger. So I'm always teaching the lads how to do various kicks and punches and all that. So I says, there was no one about. I says, watch this, bollocks, full attack. So I went straight over to this dummy and give it a front kick, straight in the chest, right? Mm. You know what's coming here, don't you? It ripped the bolts clean out of the floor, it took off, and went straight through a full, massive 8-foot plate glass window and caved it in. The dummy just went straight through the window while she's getting all the plants. I went, oh, shit. I said, run. So me and the boys just ran, got in the car and drove off and left her wheeling her plants around. And I've never been back since. It was an absolute beauty. Anyway, enough of that. I suppose I got off the subject there, but it was related in some kind of way.
It's fine. We like funny stories.
Frank's just fantastic, isn't he? Could listen to him for hours. We have got another story from Frank coming up. But let's see if... I wonder if fishing's ruined John Mack's life.
Fishing has ruined my life. And if anyone says otherwise, they're a liar. I mean, I've been married, divorced, two kids there, met another bird, stunning young bird, but fishing comes first, as always. Fishing comes first, and, work, tiling, all the rest of it, blow it out, blow the bird out, go fishing, no money, she's moaning, no money, no petrol, you can't fix your car, you know, if anyone says fishing doesn't ruin their life, they're a liar. I mean, like, fishing comes first has always been my motto, but I think I'm now 47 this year, believe it or not, and I think this year, like I say, could be the first year that fishing itself might be slightly put to the, not to the side, just a little bit on the back burner. I've fished relentlessly this winter. I mean, I've done 19 days coming up to Christmas. I had just under 45 pounds out of a really difficult lake, so there wasn't a bite for 10 weeks, and I had one. So that was good. But, this year I think fishing is gonna be second to work, and obviously I've got my new venture this year with the bait firm, so fishing ruined my life, but I'm 47, I'm not too old. They used to say if you haven't made it by the time you're 40, then you're never gonna make it. But obviously, you know, well, it's people are living a lot longer, aren't they? And I think that the other saying was, what was the other saying about being 40?
I'm 43, mate, and I feel like I'm just beginning to go down the paths I'm meant to go down.
Yeah, 40 is the best year of your life, I say. Well, I think it's going to be 50 now. So I'm aiming for the next 3 years to turn it all around about the fishing and, try and sort of... Yeah, I've sacrificed a lot, mate. I've sacrificed my house, my wealth, my marriage, not my health so much, but everything else other than my health. I've sacrificed everything to put fishing first. Selfishly, maybe, but, you know, it's addictive. You are addicted to going out there, being out there. I can't be indoors for too long. But, I'm happy at the minute, going to work, doing the bait and that, and I think there's going to be a new side to the sort of passion, and I think the passion, the passion will go to be sort of channeled into something new, you know, rather than just going fishing. Look at a professional football player or an athlete that runs, let's say, the 100 metres of his life and trains. He's committed and he's sacrificed, you know, he's sacrificed so much to get to the top of what he does. And in a similar way, we do too. And a boxer, look at a boxer, what he does to get to the top of his game. And when he comes out of boxing, he doesn't know what to do. and a football player, when they come out of professional football playing, they don't really know what to do. They're at a loss. It's an addiction is what we do, and you know, the thrill of the chase. It is an addiction. Now, obviously, I'm channeling my energy into a new venture. So, yeah, I think there's life after fishing for me, and I'm sure next winter, because we're coming out of the winter period soon, I'll be just as relentless as I always have been. But I won't be fishing all the time in the summer, that's for sure, this year. You know, I'll be too busy.
Gotta love Johnny Mac. He's so passionate, and I think that's why everybody loves him. Let's get back onto the funny stories. Who should we have first?
Well, many, many years ago, pre-sponsorship, I would like to admit that I was fishing at the North Met Pit, and I'd took the whole swing off, basically, with a bad back. I phoned into work and said that I had a bad back. And towards the end of this period off work, I'd caught my biggest fish from the lake, which was a 37-pounder. And as a result, when my friends come down to the lake that night, we had a really big party round in one of their swims. And I remember I'd drunk maybe a dozen pint cans of Stella. And as a 19-year-old, you know, that's going to have quite strong effects on you. And I remember thinking that I was okay. No, I thought that I wasn't drunk, but because I was obviously beyond the point of realising that I wasn't or I wasn't. And I said to my friend, "Can I borrow your bike?" And he said, yeah, you can borrow my bike. And so I borrowed his bike 50 yards down the park. I ended up in the lake. Well, I went straight in the lake. So they've all come up laughing their heads off. You idiot, got me out of the lake. So I've got back on the bike, gone to my van, got a change of clothes, come back to the lake, rode back in the lake for a second time. Like, literally, as soon as I got back to the lake, rode straight into it. So I've come out of the lake, gone back to the van, got changed into like the last things I had. That were like, basically, I was in my wet pants with waterproof trousers over the outside, just covering my legs up on a cold morning. And I rode into the lake for a third time. So my friends took my phone off me, and they called my girlfriend and said, "Look, you need to get this man off the lake before he gets banned. He's just can't keep himself out of the water." And luckily my girlfriend at the time, she kind of rescued me, and my gear stayed in the swim while someone else fished in it. And I went home, and I remember I had like something stupid, like an 18-hour sleep where I was so paralytic and been up all night. And I came back after my little sleep and went back into the swim, cast out, and I caught the two biggest fish in the lake. So yeah, it's quite a funny story that surrounded quite a good catch. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
The funny stories wouldn't be complete without a story from Frank, and I believe it's X-rated, this one.
My funniest session. It's a bit rude, this, Jamie. I'm allowed to do a slightly rude one.
We're not censored at all. You can say what you like.
All right. I was fishing. I got invited by a Serbian guy called Vladimir Janovic. He had his mates at bet. He's a gangster, this fella. He had his mates at bet that he could get me taking part in a match in Serbia over a game of cards and a drink in his local bar. He's a multimillionaire. So I got this strange email where this guy invited me to take part in a match in Serbia, near Belgrade. And I thought, he offered us a load of money as well to go and do it. So I thought, I've got some balls. So I thought, oh, I'll just get a plane and go. So he paid for the plane tickets, paid some money. I thought, even if it's dangerous over there, I'm going, you know. So I went, and he treated me like a king. So I asked if my mate Ardy Velkamp could go, the big Dutch guy, the bodybuilder, you know, he's a very good friend of mine. It was for teams of three to take part in this fishing competition on this lake that he knows. And they'd come from all over Europe, these people. And they were all mad on it because there was €10,000 first prize. So it turns out that the going bait on the lake was mass baiting with sweet corn. So some of these teams had like, you know, 200 them big 2 kilo cans of sweet corn. They're all spotting away, and basically, the night before the match, Vlad threw a massive party. And I mean, it was a massive party. He'd invited all these supermodels there, and it was like the bloody Oscars awards. It was televised, all sorts of stuff going on, you know. So obviously, me and Ardy had a beano, you know, had a great time, loads of drinks. It was some party, I'll tell you. It went on till 5 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. And then Vlad and Ardy inform me that they're going to stay in a hotel. So I thought, well, what about me? So he never seemed to ask that question. I think he thought I was that mad on starting, getting prepped up for the match, that I wasn't bothered. So they disappeared, and I thought, well, that's handy. My two teammates have disappeared. So the match started, I got a swim. And at that period in time, nobody in Serbia knew about plastic sweet corn. So they're all trying to use real corn on the hook or on the rig, on the hair, and it was flying off and all sorts. So I just get my plastic corn out, which I took with me, get in the swim and absolutely smash it up, and had fish up to 38 pounds, some absolute beauties. And I was leading the competition by a country mile. So it was a red-hot morning, and I was still on gold from the night before. I got hair everywhere, I looked like a Jap sniper, and... I'm in my shorts sunbathing, catching all these fish, and I was having photographs with them, and there was different film crews taking filming of me with, holding the fish. And they said, oh, you're doing ever so well, you're in the lead, and you know. And then this fairly professional-looking outfit came round, like a proper film crew, you know, with the booms and the big TV cameras. Yeah. So Vlad appears then, and Ardy, all spruced up, you know, smelling of aftershave, had a nice sort of what was left of the night in a hotel, showered and all that, and I'm covered in fish slime, hair everywhere, look like a bag of shit. So, but I'm winning. So this TV crew turn up, and Vlad says, oh, Warwick, TV crew want to make a big interview with you, you know, it's big television, you do this interview. I says, Vlad, look at the state of me, man, I don't want to appear on a TV like this. Oh, come on, Warwick, he said, this never appears in the UK, nobody knows. He says, you're in shorts, it doesn't matter. I says, but I'm covered in fish slime, Vlad. It looks like a bit of a bukkake party. Anyway... He says, oh, come on, do the interview. So this sort of chav comes over with the designer's sort of glasses on, and he's got like a permed hairstyle and a bit of a mullet on. And he's asking me all these questions. He says, okay, Molly, what do you think of Belgrade? I says, oh, it's not bad, it's nice. He says, you like the people? And yes, yeah. So we're doing this interview. It went on for about 15 minutes. He's asking all these questions. And I'm looking up at the sky, right, and I've seen this big black cloud coming. It was a clear blue sky everywhere, but there was one big black cloud, like a storm cloud. It was like a joke. And I said, oh, I think it's going to rain. He goes, no, I think it misses us. And sure enough, it came over. And you could see, you know, when you see a cloud in the distance with all the rain just peeing down. Yeah. Well, it came straight for us. We're doing this interview. Next minute, I'm in my shorts, piss wet through. Hair's wet through, and it's absolutely lashing it down like a monsoon. And he's looking down at my shorts, and he goes, ha-ha! He says, typical Englishman's. I says, what? He says, you come prepared. You have a small umbrella in your shorts. I says, no, that's me cock. Anyway, we both start laughing, right? We both start laughing, and I'm on the floor pissing myself laughing, because I'm a bit spontaneous like that, you know, a bit of a loose cannon. Mm. He's killing himself laughing. And then he says, okay, we wind up the interview now. So I'm still laughing at what I'd said. And he got a bit of a look on his face when I said it. Anyway, Vlad stood there watching, looking a bit horrified. And then Vlad's mobile phone goes off. And it's his wife who speaks very good English, Natasha. And he goes, Vlad, Natasha on phone for you. She needs to speak now. And I says, hello, Natasha, how are you? She goes, never mind that. She says, you're a crazy guy. She says, I've just peed my knickers. I says, why? She says, you're on national television on a live broadcast on the news. I went, oh, you know when you just want the ground to open? It's the biggest sport in Serbia. It was a live thing. It's like BBC One News having a live broadcast. There was no delay, nothing. It was live. And I'd said that. Can you imagine that? Oh my God. But it was funny.
Yeah, they have a national TV channel that runs across a lot of those Eastern European countries, like a fishing and hunting channel, isn't it? I don't know if that's the same one.
No, this was the main news, Jamie. This was the main news because it's a big deal. They reckon I was some kind of celebrity angler. We know it's a joke, but it was like over there, it's big news. Like, you know, and I didn't realise the significance.
I've seen it. You're a superstar in Europe. I've been in Romania, and you know your picture's up on a big billboard. And the first thing you see, well, when you speak to anybody, he realises you're English. The first thing they say is, "Do you know Frank Warwick? Do you know Rob Hughes?"
I know. It's incredible, isn't it? And it's like we're treated like football superstars. You know, I went over to Two Brothers Lakes, that tanker best, doing a competition.
That's where it was.
Yes, well, exactly. Well, they had a great big party, a pre-match party, and there was security everywhere. I thought, what's going on here? And they said, oh, you've got Bodo live on stage. I thought, who the bloody hell's Bodo? Anyway, it turns out he's their version of Sting, and he's a fanatical carp angler. So all the security was to keep all his fans out and that. And he's a big fan of mine. I ended up getting pissed and on stage singing With or Without You by U2 with Bodo. How weird is that?
It's a good place. I had a week there. I quite enjoyed it on that Two Brothers. But like I say, your face is on a billboard that was stuck up on the entrance to the gate.
Oh, Jamie, I could tell you stories about it. I took the Deputy Prime Minister of Romania fishing on Lake Reduta with me. Wow. And when we were fishing, Robert Reduta dropped it on my toes. He says, would you do me a favour? He says, I says, what? He says, number two wants to fish with you. I says, who's number two? He says, come on, you know who number two is. I says, no, it sounds like something out of some old cereal from England. He says, the prisoner. He says, number two, Deputy Prime Minister Georgios Poggio. I says, never heard of him. He says, he's the Deputy Prime Minister. He wants to fish with you now. And I says, oh, okay. He says, he's coming now. He came in with all his secret police and all his security. Anyway, and we went on a pre-baited spot, and Robert had given $5,000 worth of fox gear, everything, rods, pods, buzzers, the lot. So I had to take him, rig him up, show him how to tie rigs up and all that, you know. He wasn't too sort of competent with it. The swim was all pre-baited by Paco, the head guide over there. So we go fishing on Becker's Point, right? And overhead, there's two Chinooks flying with paratroopers in for security. Because it was about the time of the Second Gulf War when the Americans were keeping all their air force in Romania. You know. But can you imagine that? I never got a chance to get my camera out and take photos of all this either. It was so spur of the moment. It's incredible. Wow. Yeah. Wow.
That's amazing. I did like Romania, and I shall go back one day.
All right, so a funny story for you here. I went and had a little look with my mate down at Runton, next door to Vinatrope, down at Chichester, down there. And I took him over to the Outer Bounds area, and I climbed out on this fallen tree. And I've been out onto it many a time, you know, and like you've got some baits down this certain spot between a V, and you can see fish down there all the time. Anyway, so I showed him all, and I'll come and look at this. So I climbed out there. I said, right, I'll drop the baits here. I said, I'll come back. You know, there's only room for one, and I'll come back, and then he can go and have a look. I'm literally turned around, and I've been up down there so many times, and I felt myself slightly off balance, and there was these thick twines around the fallen tree that was so thick, you look at me, you think that'll hold anything. I grabbed hold of it, I literally thought, that'll hold me. Snap. And I've done a somersault, backwards somersault, fully clothed, fell out the tree, and fell into the water. I have my phone in my pocket, I swam to the edge. My mate is absolutely wetting himself with laughter. I've got out, but it's freezing cold. It was early March, and it was like, you know, I was just sort of pre-season, sort of like, you know, showing him around the sort of around the lake sort of thing. I got out of the water, I was freezing, and I was shivering. I said, come on, let's go, let's go. And he's cracking up. I went, mate, I said, it's not funny, come on, I'm here. And my phone, I switched my phone was lighting up, going on and going off and all that. And there was an old Nokia back, you know, before iPhone sort of thing. I switched it off and took the battery out and took it apart, and I'm quickly hurrying around the lake, and come out of the outer bounds, and I'm walking along the path between the two lakes of Brunton and Vinitrode. And my mate's still cracking, you know, like joking about it. And we see two blokes walking ahead, coming towards us, anglers walking around Vinitrode, having a look. I stopped, you know, and I'm like, cool as a cucumber. All right, mate. They went, all right, mate. You see, you know, you've been up to, like, have a little look about and that. I'm like, yeah. They're looking at me, just totally normal. I'm dripping, soaking. My jeans were dark blue because they were so wet, and they hadn't even noticed. And I looked at my mate and I was like, yeah, anyway, see you later then. And they just went, yeah, see you, mate, yeah, bye. Like, no mention, no looking at me funny or anything. They didn't even notice. I was soaking wet and I just walked off. But yeah, it was funny when I fell in, I'll tell you, mate. And luckily, I dried the phone on the dashboard of the van on the way home and put it back together and it worked, so... Yeah, that was a funny one. I fell in, my mate was cracking up, and the two geezers that walked past, they didn't even notice, didn't bat an eyelid. Me and my mate were just cracking up. When I went, we were in tears of laughter, so I was like, they didn't even notice, mate, and we were just cracking up.
Thanks to John. That's the end of the funny stories. As I said, this one's going to be a bit of a mishmash, just because not everybody answered all the questions. Apart from our three kind of main storytellers who seem to answer all of them, like Frank and John. They had a story for everything. Obviously, they've been around a hell of a long time. We tried to get a few tips out of some of these guys, but not all of them answered it. But we asked Alan Blair, what's his greatest edge? We asked Daryl as well, and Frank also had an edge that he wanted to share with us, as did John Mack. The game changers, the edges in the game, and I certainly learned something from this.
My greatest edge in fishing is, I believe, the ability to see what a lot of other people don't see. My biggest strength, Jamie, has been able to go onto a water with a set of polarised glasses and walk it and spot fish. Off the back of that, I've then mastered the technique of stalking them, you know, with a single hook, free lines, no floats, no messing about, creeping up on fish and presenting either to them a floating bait or, in most situations, something slow sinking. It's very, very difficult, in my opinion, if the carp are feeling obliging, for a bait to flutter down in front of their face and then not to approach it and suck it in. It has definitely caught me more big fish than any other tactic and method. And it's just very much underused. A lot of carp anglers like to get in situ, get their gear sorted, get their rods out. Me, I'd rather turn up at a lake, leave all the gear in the car, go with those glasses, go with that single rod, net, anuking mat, and go and bag myself some fish. It's definitely, without a doubt, my single most important edge in angling.
And what's your favourite slow sinking bait? Like, what would you use?
Maggots. You know, for two reasons. One, you can put a number onto a hook to regulate how fast or slow it will sink, but more importantly, it's that movement. You know, not only is it moving down through the water, as it's moving down through the water, the hook bait itself's moving, and if you watch it, it can move anywhere between sort of a centimetre left and right, back and forward, as the maggots are all wriggling on the hook. And you know, as much as a carp isn't a predatory fish, I do believe they have predatory instincts. For sure, they'll eat fry at certain times of the year, tadpoles, etc., crayfish. And to see that bunch of slow-sinking maggots, it's rare that they don't show some sort of interest in it. And in a lot of cases, suck it in, and then it's a case of nailing them. And, you know, while others are sitting there waiting for it to happen, I can be off around the lake with a single rod, causing carnage, really, catching a lot of fish.
Have you done it with worms? Have you done Absolutely. It? Have you just improvised on the bank?
Worms, bread, croissants, bits of chewing gum, anything. Really.
Chewing gum?
Yeah, anything you can mount on a hook and put it in front of a carp's face at the time, you know, it'll get you a bite, you know. Even embarrassingly, cigarette butts.
Anything. Have you?
Yeah.
You caught a fish in the cigarette butt?
Funnily enough, not carp related, but I went to Portugal a little while ago, took a load of bread with me, mashed it all up, and I was fishing for mullet. Now, mullet are renowned for being receptive to a lot of bread. Try as I might, I couldn't get them to take a mullet. As soon as I put half a cigarette butt on, I nailed them on the fly rod.
No way.
It had a fight. The cigarette butt's got a fibrous nature to it, and it's kind of fluffs out a little bit in the water. With bread, when you mount a hook into a bit of bread, you get maybe a minute before it starts falling off. A cigarette butt lasts forever.
Yeah. Sick tip.
All right, my tackle I'd never leave home without. There's a few. Definitely my glasses. Definitely my sawn-off rod and my little landing net. And probably riser pellets and maggots. You know, those two baits, riser pellets for the summer months and a soft hookable floater on the hook or a bit of bread. And in the colder months and right through the year, a nice ball of slow-sinking maggots. I definitely wouldn't leave home without that sawn-off rod, my glasses, and a little bit of bait for slow-sinking fishing.
And that's all. It's a stalking kit, basically.
Stalking kit, mate.
Seeing the fish and catching them.
Yeah.
Alan has so much enthusiasm, doesn't he? And he's definitely one of the sort of finest stalking anglers I've seen. He doesn't leave the fish alone. He harasses them, which is great. And you can obviously see from the urban banks and stuff how much passion he shares with everybody. He just loves fishing, all species, all fish. So let's get some little tips from Daryl.
Right. Okay. Right. My biggest edge in carp fishing. That's a bit of a bold statement to come out with something like that. But if I've got to pick one, I'd like to think it's my ability to adapt. You know, every water you go to is different and you don't necessarily take the same tactics with you that end up to be the downfall of that. So I'd like to think that I might not be the best at everything, but I can always turn a hand to whatever needs to be done to get the job done.
It can be, it can also be something that you just sussed out at some point, something that you learned that has stood you in good stead for forever, like whether it be something obvious like, you know, just moving on the wind, or, you know, in this type of lake the fish do this. Like, is there something that you've really kind of just worked out at some point and like it stood you in good stead everywhere you've been?
Well, but yeah, you could say, I know it's probably something very cheesy for some people to understand, to hear me say, but like feeling the lead down, for example. You know, it's a common thing, we all do it these days, but there's interpretation of your idea of what that's landed on, and I've always liked to believe that because I've experienced the drops that have led to bites and the ones that haven't, you know, that sometimes I just know, like when I find a spot, that I know that I will catch off it, not just because it's a rock hard drop, but because it's a drop in a zone where the fish are visiting and you just find something out there, you know. So I would say, yeah, another edge would be finding that spot and having the confidence from, or the experience from previous catches, to know that, yeah, that's worth persevering from, and that is a spot that will do bites.
I'm glad you brought that up, actually. I remember we've had a few conversations about this spot. And sometimes you just find a spot, don't you, and you know that's the one. And sometimes you get a cast on that spot where you go, I'm leaving that till I go home. Like, that was the one. And I know a lot of the biggest fish I've ever caught, it was always the one. You know, it was always, wow, that went down better than any of the other casts that I've had. And you've caught, you know, the fish you're after.
Yeah. You hear people talking about fishing in the silt and that the silty spots are better than the gravel and all that mumbo jumbo. But I tell you now, if a fish crashes out in front of me and I sling out at it and it cracks down first time, like 100%, there's no doubt in my mind that that's not hit terra firma, then those are the ones that do the bites. The ones that you think, yeah, it's all right, they occasionally go, but the ones, those mornings when you see one, it goes out there first chuck and it smacks down and you catch one, you're just like, and then you re-interrogate that area, you know, and sometimes it leads to multiple takes. You know, that one fish is giving away that one spot, that one cast has put you in there, like in the honey hole. And yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for knowing rather than hoping.
The honey hole, I like that. The spots within the spots, I mean, if you must have had the situation where only you can catch out of a peg and you're hammering it and someone else goes in after you and they don't catch, you go back in, you have three or four again and you end up fine-tuning the spot even more, don't you?
Well, I thought that a little bit at Yateley because back in the day, obviously, a lot of people were using bait boats out there, so they're finding the gravel, dropping the rig next to it. And there's still the potential on any spot for there to be a little bit of debris here and there. But when you get that absolute transmission through the rod that leaves the rod just trembling when it's just like gone down, like Ian Botham's down there with his big bat and just smacks it back towards you, then I did think that at the time, that it might be not just a baking scenario like that, that knowing, absolute knowing that I've smacked onto those tiny little gravel patches that they obviously cleared off in the sill to someone driving a boat out there and thinking that they're landing on it.
What do you think it is when you get that absolute smack? Do you think it's just the fact that your rig's presented perfectly and it's on the actual dinner plate, like you say, the spot that they've just cleaned? I think it's a combination of everything. Like when you get that right cast, it hits the clip at the right point, it drops back just nice. Do you think it's the whole bit of it?
I think it can be different reasons, you know. It can, on, like say, those patches at Yateley, those tiny little dinner plates as such, you know, they've obviously been cleared, because I remember going into the bathroom after catching those fish a year later and the spot wasn't as it was, you know. I could find gravel on the float, but when I cast the lead next to it, I couldn't get the drops that I was getting before, and I think in that scenario it was, I was probably landing it in the equivalent of a sink, you know, like a real small, probably 2 by 2 foot sort of area on the spot that they were really keen on, I think, and that in that situation, that was the honey hole as such. But going back to the, you see a fish show, you cast out there and you get that explosive drop first cast, it's just, if you make it easy for the carp to find it, i.e. it's not hidden by any bottom debris or anything like that, you've got that drop because you've nailed down on clean bottom, the bait's visible. If the fish is out there feeding and it's, the bait's highly visible to it, but not giving it a reason not to take it, then you've done everything you can in your power to give it the opportunity to take it. And I'm sure that, you know, I know from float fishing on the river, when I've seen carp in the edge, you know, I've put bread down and I'm watching them come in, and sometimes if you just pulled it up on top of a brick so it was more visible than the rest, the next time it came into the swim it would take that one first. So I think it just goes back to that. If you make it easy for the fish, then you're giving it every opportunity to take it.
And would you still describe like spot fishing as like the most important factor? Like obviously you need to know where fish are and the location's important, but you know, when you find an area you're thinking, right, I need a spot, are you constantly looking for the best spot in that area? Or will you, you know, rather than, here's a classic example, you know, when you like move into fish, you may know the peg but not like the back of your hand, and you know there's fish in the area, or there's likely to be, maybe they're going to move on the wind that's blowing that way. Will you just keep looking till you find that ultimate spot, or will you go kind of, well, that's good enough, I know I can get a bite off that, there might be a better spot in the area but I'm not going to risk messing the swim up type thing?
Well, my opening gambit on any lake that I start on these days is just turn up on a wheelbarrow at dawn and cast to what I see, and I initially do that for the start of all my campaigns. Rather than go round some the whole lake, I just fish to where I see them jump. And generally what I do then is then I'll plumb those markers that I've seen them show on after the event. So whether I catch or not during that first session when I'm freestyling, I really look into, when I'm campaign fishing, you know, the more the campaign goes on, the more I've sort of seen fish show, the more I've plumbed in those zones. And it quite often comes into its own in the autumn, you know. In the spring, the freestyle seems to work really, really well. And then over the course of the summer, the weed comes up, it gets to its peak, and then it starts to go back down the other way. And I often find the fish, they move less in the autumn. They're still moving around, but they seem to, I've often found they concentrate around the central, deeper areas of the lake at times. And that's when I specifically really start digging out these spots where I keep seeing regular activity. And then once you've found that honey hole and you can start applying that bait out there, then you can get into spots, get swims rocking, and you're the only one that can get bites out there at times.
Yeah, totally agree.
Some absolutely fantastic stuff in there. I've had many, many hours of conversations with Daryl about spots, specific spots. And if anything, I've stopped fishing extremely spotty. We have spoke about this in the normal carp cast, Mark and I. But it used to be one of my edges is fine-tuning a peg, finding the spots within the peg to, you know, you'd have 3 rods in a peg and you'd maybe struggle in the peg for a while and then you'd find a spot that you get a bite on. So, like every time you go in that peg, that rod will always go on that spot. That's kind of like your banker spot. And then you end up, you know, you persevere with the other two rods, moving them around until you get a spot, bite off a different spot. All of a sudden you've got two spots. Eventually you find a third spot you can get a bite on. And then the next time you're in that peg, you've got three rods all on spots that you're really confident in. And then the more time you do in that peg, you can fine tune in it again. You might find a different spot or just fish one spot more effectively, where you get even more bites off it. And all of a sudden, you can just be hammering that peg. You know, every time you go in it, you can pick up a bite because you found feeding areas is basically what it is. And I've had loads of those conversations with Daryl. He's very particular about the spot, and I've stopped doing it in recent years. I've started fishing, I've started being more aware. Rather than fishing the peg to the best of my ability, I've been more aware of just trying to get on fish. And I think if you set up on fish, you can't marker up for 4 or 5 hours. You've kind of just got to put them out in the area. And that also catches your fish. So I think you need to do a combination of both. You know, I think you need to keep your eyes open, be prepared to move instantly. But get to know every peg to the best of your ability. And preferably the best time to do that is obviously when the fish aren't there. But I used to never catch on my first night in a peg. I used to just lead around all day till I found, you know, even if I found a nice spot, there might be a better one a bit nearer, or one that's right up against, you know, a thick wall of weed that's just double feedy. And I would sometimes mess my chances up for the first 24 hours, and then I'd fine tune everything, spot it up, and then quite often I'd catch on the second day, which is great if you've got 3 nights a week, but it's absolutely no good if, you know, you fish 24 hours a week. The most important thing is to just present somehow, whether it be with a chod or a zig, just in an area where there are actually fish present. But yeah, it's great to get inside Daryl's mind. And then let's see, probably one of the people that's opened my eyes to tiny little tweaks, changes and edges all the way through, and that's Frank Warwick.
My greatest edge in fishing, that's a big one, because I've had a few over the years. What I've tended to do, to be honest, is I get bored. And I can't stand being in a lottery where you're doing similar to everyone else, and then you're just waiting for your time to come, or, you know, relying on a bit of watercraft, extra sort of location and stuff like that. I've always been restless, so I like to have something that's a game changer. And all my best sessions, or my best periods in my life, have come from using the old grey matter rather than small things. It's been quite big moves to make something special that resonates. Like the single hook bait, the fluoros, was one of them that I could easily quote, you know. I remember I was on Reedsmere, 1981, and I was in a rut, really. I was doing the same as everybody else to a degree, you know, using an old wrist rocket. We used to think that 70, 80 yards worth of fishing, we're putting in about a pound of bait and thinking that was heavy baiting. And it was like a lottery whether you actually catch anything. You know, everyone was all doing the same thing. And I thought, I can't be doing with this. It's not doing what I need to be doing. And I'd had this plan in my head that if I used to see fish fizzing in the middle of the lake, but it's 44 acres, the mere, and I was thinking, would they find a single hook bait out in the middle of that lake? It sort of seems ridiculous. So it was going through my head, and I thought, I'd got some 2.5 pound tri-cast rods, which we classed as long-range rods at that time, because everyone had 1¾ and 2 pound spiralites and things like that. So I was quite a good caster, and I thought, do you know what? I'm going to try fishing a single. So I've been on for 48 hours. I was coming to the end of the session, I had to pack up to go to work, and I thought, and I'd made up this batch of bright orange, as bright as a good gerund, pop-ups with a piece of square polystyrene inside them. We didn't have cork balls in them days or anything like that, so I'd made some pop-ups, and I thought, I want them so they blow your head off, so there's a lot of smell coming off them, as bright as possible. And I'm going to sit them up off the bottom, and cause bear in mind, we'd only just got the hair. And I was thinking, people just weren't using pop-ups, so I'd made some, and I thought, right, I'm gonna try them. So I set this one set up with about 6 inches off the bottom, and I had a 2.5 foot hook length on there, nylon hook length, and a 4 ounce lead, shot lead, and I waded out to the top of the waders, and I got 20 minutes to go, and I cracked it right out in the middle of the mirror. I was in the the left-hand holly swim, and I come wading back to the bank, and the Tomlinsons were up there, the Tomlinson brothers and Steve Cook and loads of other people, and they all said, "What the hell are you doing?" And I says, "I'm just going to try something." As I'm wading back to the bank, I'm talking, and they were all like, "Poor, that'll never work." Anyway, I thought, hang on, the line's tightened up here. So I hit it, and I got a 19-pounder on. So I'd not even got back to the bank, and I got a 19 on a single hook bait, a bright one, blasted out. Anyway, I remember Lee Tomlinson came over, he said, "You lucky bastard." He says, that's the luckiest bite or thing I've ever seen in my life. That'll never happen again. So I did no more than wade out, cracked it out to roughly the same area, come back. I was just putting the indicator on the needle, putting it in a Roberts adjustable line clip, and it whipped out the clip, and I had an 18-pounder. So I got two fish in less than 20 minutes. Did it again and lost one. So I thought, what have I found here? I mean, now we wouldn't even think twice about it, or, you know, over the years, but then it was like, it was a massive change, a leap of faith to do that. And I remember I had to go to work on the airport, Manchester Airport, for 4 days, and all I could get, I couldn't get it out of my mind, thinking, I can't wait to get back and do it again. So I got, I virtually ran with the rods after the 4 days' work. I'd just finished a 12-hour night. I was knackered. Ran with the rods. There was someone in the left-hand dolly in the swim where I fancied, because I wanted to be in the same swim. So I went in the snag instead. Put it on two rods this time, blasted them out, exactly the same thing, and they're all looking round at me like I was a lunatic. Got in the bivvy, nothing happened. I was expecting a bite, but it never happened. I thought, oh, maybe it was just a massive stroke of luck. Anyway, I went through the night, sort of waking up thinking, I can't believe I've not had a bite. But as we know now, singles at night are not the one, really. Anyway, just as it was getting light, I heard the line whipping out the line clip, and I got a screaming run. I had a 24-pounder. And then the other rod went, and that was the start of it all then. Do you know what? They all sat and watched me for a whole season because no one had the gear to do it. But they couldn't get their head round the fact that I was catching them on singles. And a lot of people hadn't seen it, was saying, how are you getting the free offerings out there? So I'm not telling you. So I conned them into thinking I was somehow baiting up. Yeah. And there was all these theories going around, Jamie. One of them was that I'd got some giant polystyrene shoes and was waded out in the middle of the night on these floating polystyrene shoes baiting up. So there was all kinds of bullshit going on.
I'm still not. I'm one of them who likes bait. Like, I rarely stick a single out. So
yeah,
for somebody like me. I mean, obviously I know it works. What do you think it is? Do you think it's a bit like the Zigs now, where it's just a pure curiosity factor and they see it right in front of their nose and they go, I can't resist that? Or why does it work so well?
Well, when you think about it, Jamie, when you, even on a baited area, the fish have got to encounter one bait first.
Yeah.
And take it. So there's always a starting point, whether you've got bait in, a lot of bait or no bait. But I think one hook bait, I mean, don't forget, I was fishing in a sanctuary, a safe area out there where they'd never been touched. So they were, it's like fishing in a snag that you're not allowed to fish in.
Yeah.
And it's never seen a hook bait. The bottom's completely scoured like marble, where they've had every single food item where they feel safe. It's polished.
Yeah.
So that them fish, they seen that and thought, oh, happy days, piece of food where it's safe, where it can't possibly have a rig attached or any kind of association with pressure. So in the early days, it was unbelievably exceptional. I was getting 5 and 6 fish in a morning on a water where, you know, you might get 10 fish in a year if you were extremely on your game on bait, fishing well.
Yeah.
It was a complete game changer, and it worked. Every single water I took it, virtually, it worked.
So you think it's just because it wasn't on a baited patch, and like even on other waters where you're not in the safe area, you're just fishing a single. Do you think it's just because it's not associated with danger, because it's not bait, that just they see it and away they go?
Well, they like, I think they like children. I think basically, when I was fishing birch, for example, I've watched them over bright fluoro in the snags. I've seen a fish come and spook off it, see it and just panic and belt off. And I've seen the fish, been watching it, and then I've caught the very same fish a couple of hours later.
Wow.
On that rig. The same fish that's bolted off and panicked, it's come back and had it. Because I think they're like children. I think they think, they're seeing it, it negs them, and they're thinking, I want that, but if I don't have it, someone else is going to have it. So I think sooner or later they take it on.
Yeah,
and if we strong. Only knew... Yeah, I think if we only knew, I think they're constantly taking us on. And I think if we had underwater cameras all the time and we're watching what they're doing, they're stripping us of bait and taking our rigs on, and we don't know nothing about it. I think they're hammering us.
Yeah.
Because don't forget, I started in the 1970, so we were using paste baits. Where the hook was buried in the paste, and the fish were completely and utterly taking you on all the time, because you weren't hooking them most of the time. It was they were just taking the piss. They were sucking the paste off the baits. And we used to use the old squeezy bottle tops, and it never stayed still. They were at it all the time, because a lot of the time we used to think baiting up heavy then with balls of paste was about 10 balls of paste around your hook bait.
Yeah.
So they were gone instantly, and then they were whittling away at your hook bait. As soon as we got on the hare on the same waters, we're getting like 20 runs a day. So that, even in winter, like, you know, when you think it, we used to think winter fishing was incredibly slow and impossible. As soon as we got on the hare, we're catching all the way through the winter, which told you that they were moving not as much as in the summer, or not feeding as heavy, but we were catching them. And that was a great level, and that taught me everything, because it showed what they were doing and revealed that they were eating a lot more than we ever thought. And I think simply now, a lot of people are saying, oh, the fishing's slow in winter and that. They're just more adept at taking our rigs on and getting shut of the lot and eating all our free offerings constantly.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. If you had to use one single hook bait forever, what's the ultimate single hook bait?
I've got loads of favourites, but I think my favourite one that was a game changer really was the old Scopex and blackcurrant one that I used to use. That was exceptional. The pineapple, obviously, with the M-butyric acid. I used to work at Trebs and Wimble. Yeah, I mean, I remember, Bill, it was all but dead M-butyric acid, and I started experimenting with it sort of in the 80s, and I realised, I went to the Manchester Central Library and did a lot of research, and I found that M-butyric acid's a weird compound in that it's more water soluble. The colder the water, the more soluble it is. So there's more leakage when the water's cold. So I realised that in cold temperatures, I could put a lot more in and it would be giving off a big signal. And it's obviously a very well-known attractor for carp. Yeah. So I combine that, and it works well with fruits and citric acid. So I started using it with the old mainline pineapple. And I remember getting a load off Bill Cottam, and he goes, and I wrote about it like an idiot. And I said, and he said, do you know what? You've kick-started this craze for M-butyric acid. We were going to bin that and not do it anymore. Now we've got to start bottling all that shit up through you. You know, but some of the dosages on it, Jamie, I've used extremely high. It's not one of those things that you can overload easy. You can get away with a lot of that in your single hook baits. A lot. A lot more than people think.
Very interesting.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've got some. There was one thing that I wanted to tell you about edges that have made something special for me that I think would be worth hearing about.
Okay.
So that's back to if for start again, it's like things, edges that have made a special difference to what I'm doing.
Yep.
Right. The one that stands out in my mind, and it's given quite a lot away, this. I have wrote about it, but it's gone over people's heads. But whenever I've tried it, it's made a huge difference. And what it is when we use boilies, basically in a baited area, we tend to use boilies of out of the bag or the package or whatever you want to do that have been rolled, and you make your hook bait as similar to them as possible, or else indeed we use one out of the bag, out of the same batch. But people are getting more concerned about balancing the rigs now, so there's a lot of people using wafters and that, you know, which is good. But I wasn't happy with my results over bait, because I'd observed on the bottom syndicate at Cape Thornall, I'd been up the trees and on top of the syndicate watching what the fish were doing, and they were busy cleaning you out and differentiating between your hook bait and the freebies, because your hook bait is never ever ever going to behave the same as free offerings, because it's attached to the rig obviously, and you've got the weight of the hook on there and the tethering effect. And so what I did was, even though it's a minuscule change, they could tell the difference. So what I did, I got my hook and my hook length, and I got a piece of cork, and I got a bucket of water, and I'd get the cork, stick it on the point of the hook. Obviously, it lifts the whole thing up with a fairly big piece of cork. So what I'd do is I'd trim the cork until it only just lifted the hook and the hook link. Only just. So that'd end up like an 8mm piece of cork, and then I'd put that inside my hook baits and roll them. So I did it with every single one. The difference that made was ridiculous, because it negated the weight of the hook and the hook link away. Yeah. And I suddenly found that one small change made a huge difference to my captures. But I wasn't happy with that. I wanted to try take things a bit further. So what I did, I got my free offerings. I thought, what about really upsetting the apple cart and making it so that they really, really can't find my hook bait? I'm going to completely confuse them and throw a spanner in the works. So what I did, I got my baits, and in the old days before we had proper pop-ups, I used to experiment baking hook baits to make pop-ups or wafters in an oven. You probably remember that, and have done it yourself.
Yeah, I tried it. I'm never any good at it.
No, and then my mum got a microwave, a very early microwave, so I thought, oh, happy days. So we're microwaving baits to make pop-ups and wafters. And depending on how long you put them in the microwave for was how buoyant they were. And then they change buoyancy when they cooled off. You probably know all about that.
Yeah.
So I thought, right, let me get my free offerings. So I put them on a big saucer. So I got about 50 baits or 70 baits, put them in the microwave, and I'd give them like 30 seconds. Check them out, check the buoyancy, and that had altered the buoyancy. So I got the next batch, another 70 baits, put them in on the plate, give them 45 seconds. Next batch, 60 seconds. Next batch, 1 minute, 15 seconds. And so on and so on, all the way up to 2 minutes, where they're almost pop-ups, but when they cool off, they only just sank. Then I'd mix all of them together. So all my baits, all my free offerings, were all different buoyancies, all mixed together, including some normal bottom baits, okay? Yeah. So I took them in a bucket of water, mate, and then they were bouncing about. Some were sinking slow, some fast, some in between. Everything you can think of was in there. So I thought, right, okay, that's going to upset them. They'll never be able to guess which is the hook bait now, and everything when they come in the swim will be lifting up and bouncing around. It'll completely confuse them. Oh, my yeah. God, did it work? Well, I did it on Reedsmead, didn't I? And I went on opening day and had 14 runs and landed 11.
Wow, I've never heard that before. I mean, I do something similar called confusion tactics, but I do it rather than different buoyancy boilies, I do it with just different stuff in my spud mix. So, you know, you've got tigers,
yeah,
corn, maize, boilies, no two things act the same because they're just different sizes and different weights, but you've done it with Boyley with the same
Exactly, Jamie. Well, the thing is, you no need to fanny about with the microwave. As I progressed and learned more about baits, I started using ingredients and making bespoke batches by adding shrimp meal and krill, which are buoyant ingredients, and I just changed the amount of shrimp meal and krill that I was putting in the base mix in fish meals, so that I achieved that by just putting more and more shrimp meal in, for example, so that I could alter. It's incredible, Jamie. Yeah, and I can guarantee that when some of these bait companies hear about this, they'll all be on the bandwagon, all wanting to do this, because it's the final edge. For those people that really like using just boilies, that are boilie anglers, this is the ultimate edge because it completely throws a spanner in the works. And when the more you think about it, the more fascinating it is. And I tried it on birch, get this. I was a lazy pig. We all get lazy because it's a lot of time and effort involved. But then I thought, why don't I try that? And I had 12 fish in the winter on birch in a day, which was interesting because Paul Selman's rotor, he was on the other rotor, they had four fish all winter between them, four guys on their rotor.
That's an edge. That's definitely an
edge. Yes, it's an edge, Jamie, that one. That's a proper edge. So, I mean, I've got tons more things, but that was a super-duper game changer. And the interesting thing was a lot of the hook hold that I had were right down the back of the throat as well, so it completely thrown a spanner in the works and done the business, basically.
Every time I talk to Frank, I consider my mind blown. He's just got so many tricks, and he's just inquisitive, I think, by nature. And if you haven't learned something from that or tickled the old grey matter, then I don't know what's going to do it for you. Frank's just brilliant, isn't he? I think the last edges we've got are from John Mack, so let's go and check out the Kent geezer.
Okay, game changers. Well, to be fair, again, I don't think I've got one particular game changer. There are certain edges that you can sort of adopt, but it's a culmination of many edges that make your game change, you know. But there are certain things that I've learned and adopted over the years, especially, you know, last year, just over a year ago, I pursued with my Zig fishing. That's a game changer in the right circumstances. I've had 40s, by the way, in every single month of the year other than February up till last year. And last year, I set out, that whole winter evolved around the build-up to February. And I fished for weeks doing the Zigs. And this particular time that I cracked it, Zigs has always been something that I sort of just chuck it out. I think, yeah, mid-water or up there or wherever, up there or foot below. And I kind of, oh, I have a go. And I put it on one rod. And it didn't never really happen, although many people ask me about zig fishing, and I knew how to do it really well. I'd tell them and give them all the info. I mean, this is years ago as well, you know, before it became so popular now. But I never really adopted it and tried it, you know, like thoroughly. This year, though, particularly, I set out to absolutely catch this 40-pounder in February, and I nailed the zig fishing, and basically what I did, I spent 3 days in a swim and I'd fish 3 rods, all on zigs, 3, 4, 5 foot, then another 24 hours at 6, 7, 8 foot, then another 24 hours at 9, 10, 11 foot. So I'd have one, you know what I mean, one at each step, and cover the whole column, water column, within a swim from, you know, basically sort of 3 foot up to a foot below, basically. And then I'd move swim and I'd do the same thing, 3, 4, 5, for 24 hours, 6, 7, 8, 24 hours, 9, 10, 11. Then I'd move swim. And I'd done 12 days of doing this, until I foul looked one in a swim, and then I had to go home. I know, like, it's controversial, but, you know, if it's done correctly, you know, I've never had any problems with it. But, yeah, certain waters are banning it these days. But anyway, so we'll carry on. But it can be a game changer. But, again, I came back and I set, this time I knew the depth. So I set up in the same swim and I put one at 6 foot, one at 6.5 foot, and one at 7 foot. The 6.5 foot one went. And it was a really good fish, and I lost it. Lost the fish, the hook pulled. I was convinced it was a proper bite, you know, in the mouth, not a foul looker. I see the fish towards the end. I see the fish come right up towards the end, and then it turns, and it was up, mouth up, and it turned and powered off, and the hook popped out. But again, the next day I put them out at 6, 6.5, 7 foot, because I'd got one at 6 or whatever it was, you know, the week before foul looks. So I put them all at around that depth, and then the next day I had a 46.10 or whatever it was, 46.5, can't remember, slate grey out of Christchurch, at 6.5 foot. And yeah, that's a game changer, mate, a game changer. But you really have to, you have to just work at it. You have to really work at it and work out where they are, find out where they are, because they are there, and they will have them. They do have them.
I'm the same.
Bit of black foam at night as well, by the way.
I've done the same as you. When I have fished things, I fish them kind of half-heartedly, one rod or two rod. I really like what you've done there with the three different depths and just changing it every 24 hours. I think that's, you know, you've sussed it, haven't you? By the time you get the bite, you've sussed it.
Put it this way, I think if I did it again, I'm so confident that I'll nail it. That is the way to do it. You do 24 hours with three rods, one at one depth, one close to it, one close to that. Then you put them out of the same area. You know roughly where the fish are. I mean, come on, you know, sort of middle-ish is good. Let's face it. But, you know, and adjust your depths. Do 3 days in there. Move, do 3 days in there. Move, do 3 days in there. But all different depths. Absolutely work it, work it, work it. And I tell you what, it's just as effective as staying up all night, walking around the lake, casting at shine fish, because you're constantly changing. Therefore, you're not static fishing. You're not just chucking out a bit of foam or fluff, whatever they want to call it these days, but, you know, and sitting there and hoping. I absolutely worked it and nailed it, and that fish got me that, you know, literally that got me the 46 pounder. Those eggs, I suppose, can be a game changer.
Big thank you to John. And that wraps it up for this time. There's quite a few edges, tips, tricks, and stories. I hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Carpcast Extra. Next month, we'll have a whole new group of guests. So we've finished with the guys. Like I say, big thank you to Ronnie DeGroote, Kevin Nash, Alan Blair, John Mack, Daryl Peck. And obviously Frank Warwick. Big thanks to you guys. And next month there'll be the same questions, but with a completely new group of anglers. See you then. Okay.